I think I have to start this episode off with an apology. With my ill planning, I hadn't realized that the cliffhanger I left you on last week would mean 2 whole weeks of suspense, thanks to Reading Week. So, if you listen weekly, I apologize if you lost any sleep over not knowing what happened to David Bowie after this turbulent time in the spotlight and the release of Station to Station. That being said, I won't waste any more time explaining myself, so let's roll the intro and get right into it. Good afternoon, Golden Hawks, and thank you for tuning in to Radio Laurier. My name is Megan, and you are listening to The Downbeat, a show where I get into the nitty-gritty, the deep cuts, and the hot topics of rock and roll throughout the decades. This week, how David Bowie made a career out of being someone else, part two. Last week, we went through the first half of Bowie's incredibly impressive and lengthy career, particularly highlighting how he managed to build it upon the power of persona. From Major Tom to the Thin White Duke, Bowie portrayed 5 different characters of sorts over the span of a 7-year period. We left Bowie at a challenging time. In the thick of a cocaine addiction, in a city that he didn't much like, it seemed as though he needed a change. So what is a rock star with endless means to do? Well, move to West Berlin during the height of political tension, of course. In 1976, David Bowie made the move from Los Angeles to West Berlin. To most, this may seem like a questionable decision. Why move to Germany during the height of Cold War tension when you could live in comfortable, sunny LA? Well, I think that was just the problem. Bowie was getting too comfortable in LA. In interviews, Bowie stated that LA was fueling his addiction. It was far too easy to get drugs, food, or whatever a rock star might need by simply picking up the phone. He decided that if he was going to get clean, which he desperately needed given that he did so much blow he barely remembers the LA chapter of his life, he needed to move to an environment that was completely different to that of Southern California. What attracted Bowie to Berlin, and what made it the site of so much of his best work, was the autonomy and independence it provided him with. He had to buy his own plane ticket and go to the shop for his own groceries. He could walk the streets without being stopped or analyzed. You see, in America, Bowie was a rock star, but oftentimes he felt as though he were an animal at the zoo during encounters with interviewers or fans. He wasn't treated as a human being. They never saw him like that. In his mission to appear strange and perform as anything but himself, Bowie turned himself into a spectacle in the eyes of the public. But not in Berlin. In a Rolling Stone interview in 1979, Bowie said, "One thing about Berliners, they're very matter-of-fact about celebrities, music, trends, whatever. It makes it a very good place for someone like me to live because I can be incredibly anonymous. You never get stopped here. They don't seem particularly joyful about seeing a famous face." So, thanks to this new freedom, Bowie was able to buckle down and focus on 2 things: getting sober and making music. On his trip to Berlin, he took with him his close friend and collaborator, the king of the New York punk scene, Iggy Pop. Together, they worked with producer Tony Visconti and English musician Brian Eno to make a total of 5 albums. The first was Iggy Pop's debut solo album, The Idiot, which Bowie co-wrote. He also assisted in the production of Iggy's 2nd album, Lust for Life, during his time in Berlin. The other 3 are what are now better known as Bowie's Berlin Trilogy. The first, released in 1977, was Low. Low is a clear shift from the guitar-based rock that was previously commercially successful for Bowie. We began to see the divide with young Americans as Bowie took influences from soul music. Station to Station also verged from guitar rock with its experimental, harsh sound, but Low is something entirely different. The album could be described as electronic, ambient, art rock, and experimental rock, with influence from the German music style krautrock. This genre in itself was a shift in the German music scene from blues-rooted rock to a more experimental, avant-garde style. There's a notable divide in the album, with side one being, as Bowie put it, about himself and his prevailing moods at the time, and side two being about his musical observations on living in Berlin. This duality is further emphasized in that five tracks are completely instrumental, while six contain Bowie's vocals. Another notable characteristic of the album is its use of drums. Well, if you can even call it that. After all, it was 1977, and the synthesizer frenzy of the 80s was just around the corner. Visconti used an Eventide H910 harmonizer, I hope I said that right, which he hooked up to a snare drum to produce the harsh drum sound heard in tracks such as Sound and Vision. The harmonizer was able to modify the pitch of sounds without changing their speed, making for a sound like this. Always crashing in the same car. All right, so now that we've got the general feel of this album and its sound, let's have a listen to some notable tracks. The album's opening track, Speed of Life, is completely instrumental. The track does an excellent job of setting the tone for the album, which is incredibly important given that there is no running storyline or character to follow in Low. Unlike the majority of his past works, Low focuses more on tone and atmosphere than it does on a thematic concept. The art rock sound of the album is immediately established, and it becomes clear that this is going to be a Bowie album like no other. No wonder so many respectable Bowie fans claim it as their favorite. Likely the most memorable song from the album is Sound and Vision. After all, it made it onto the compilation album after his death, so what more evidence do you need? Personally, Sound and Vision was the first song from Low that I had ever heard, and it immediately became one of my favorites of Bowie's. It's a rarity that I find a song with a nearly minute and a half introduction that I enjoy this much. It ties together the use of brass, remember Soul Love on the Rise and Fall, with a new synth sound we've never heard before from Bowie. Sound and Vision is the perfect representation of a new Bowie, a precursor for the rest of the fantastic music that would come out of his time in Berlin. Have a listen. Don't you wonder sometimes about Sound and Vision? The songs off of Low are definitely more experimental than that of his past work, but that's not to say that they are lacking in terms of rock appeal. The guitar work on Breaking Glass is great for those who want exposure to this new sound, but are still partial to some of Bowie's more guitar-driven offerings. If you're more pop-inclined, I would give track number 3 a listen, What in the World. The use of electronic instruments is immense, and the song itself is a bit more structured than other tracks on the album. You're just a little girl with gray eyes. Never mind, say something, wait until the crowd cries. Always Crashing in the Same Car is another favorite of mine. It's a tad less upbeat than Sound and Vision, and, to put it plainly, a tad more dramatic in tone. This is another great listen for the guitar alone, and excellent representation of what the Berlin era really was. But I'm always crashing in the same car. The rest of the album, from track 7 onward, is almost entirely instrumental. Remember when I said that the album had a divide? The initial divergence starts at the track A New Career in a New Town, and carries on for the rest of the album, with a large use of synthesizers and brass instruments that make for an almost ethereal sound. As I mentioned before, Bowie said the second half of the record is based on his musical observations of being in Berlin. I take this as the songs are influenced by the politically tense atmosphere of the time, as well as the innovative music scene that was developing. However, don't let this scare you off. The rest of Low is equally as good as the first, as long as you're willing to open yourself up to the idea of 23 minutes of Bowie music, well, without Bowie. To hear what I'm talking about, here's a clip from track 9, Art Decade. Thank you. So, that is 1977's Low. Now, to put it into perspective in terms of Bowie's progression as a performer through Persona, this discussion we've been having for the past 2 weeks, well, the point is that there is none. To backtrack a bit, yes, we have seen and heard Bowie as strictly Bowie before, and I touched upon this in the previous episode. The thing about Low is it is in fact strictly Bowie, but at a time in his life when he was trying to establish who he really was. It is important to remember that right up until the Berlin era, Bowie was a warped version of himself. He barely remembers his time as the Thin White Duke, and during the time he took up that persona, he was a borderline fascist with a drug problem. Bowie moved to Berlin to ground himself, and it shows in his music. Station to Station was innovative, there isn't questioning it. But Low is, in my opinion, the first true turning point in Bowie's career for the first time since The Rise and Fall. It allowed Bowie to find his footing in a sober, true, conscious state of mind, and therefore enable him to again reinvent himself, just this time in a more mundane and self-reflective form. But, as I said, Low is only the first of three albums in the Berlin Trilogy. The second, and possibly one of his best known, was released in the same year as Low. That album was Heroes. Release of Low earlier in the year, Bowie decided to tour as a keyboardist with his friend Iggy Pop to promote his first Berlin album, The Idiot. After this, they recorded Iggy's second solo album, Lust for Life, and then Bowie set off to record his own second hitter, Heroes. Interestingly enough, unlike the other two albums of the Berlin Trilogy, which were only partially recorded in Germany, fun fact, Heroes was entirely recorded and produced in Berlin, again with the help of Brian Eno and Tony Visconti. Much like Low, Heroes can be described as electronic, ambient, art rock, or experimental rock. In terms of tone and atmosphere, which are again highlighted rather than having an album centered around a storyline or theme, think Rise and Fall, the album is a bit more lighthearted than Low. Structure follows the same split pattern as Low, with the second half being mainly instrumental. One key difference, however, is the most compelling song of the album, the title track, is actually the longest of the album, totaling in at 6 minutes and 11 seconds. Unlike Low's heavy hitter, Sound and Vision, Heroes builds to an emotional climax rather than delivering this kind of constant groove. There's no wonder why the song is so often used in films for monumental scenes. Listening to it can be an emotional experience on its own. Aside from Heroes, there are plenty of other fantastic songs on the record. Beauty and the Beast, the other single from the album, has a bit of a soulful feel that is well balanced by the use of synth and electronica. And before you ask, no, it sounds nothing like that Justin Bieber song. The album's fourth song, Sons of the Silent Age, dares to go where the A-sides of Low did not. Where some of them, such as Always Crashing in the Same Car and Be My Wife, are a step in the more experimental and slow direction, they still rely on a bit of rock and roll flair with steady guitar woven through them. But with Sons of the Silent Age, Bowie substitutes this flair with a heartful soul and plenty of building background vocals. It is, yet again, a great example of Bowie's progression as an artist. It becomes clear, both with this song and the album as a whole, that Bowie has succeeded in his mission of finding himself in Berlin. So, here's a clip from the song, because I know you're waiting for it.
Sons of the Silent Age, stand on platforms, blank books and notebooks.
Overall, the A-sides on this album are far more positive sounding in comparison to the record's predecessor. Bowie sings with a great deal more passion and what I can only describe as a hopeful tone. Looking to the instrumental songs on the record, this is where it becomes clear to me that Heroes is a direct extension of Low. It's even more experimental, it's even more ambient, it's just more. So if you enjoyed the B-sides on Low, you'll love that of Heroes. There's also some clear Japanese influence in many of the instrumentals, especially Moss Garden. So if you're into that, you're in luck. Possibly the weirdest track on the entire album is Sense of Doubt, in that it strays more towards sounds than music in the first half, but that's not to say it isn't worth a listen. In this way, the album can be a bit more gloomy than Low at times, but what I love most about it is when it's dark, it's dark. But when it's lighthearted and uplifting, is it ever? Overall, Heroes is probably recognized as Bowie's most influential album of all time. I won't comment on that, as I'm highly unqualified, but what I will say is that the title track is likely one of his best ever written, and I stand by that. Now, the third installment of the Berlin trilogy is admittedly less important. For many Bowie fans, the ultimate albums include The Rise and Fall, Station to Station, Low, and Heroes. Many people even go as far as to lump Station to Station in with the first two albums of the Berlin trilogy, to name it as Bowie's prime. And admittedly, I agree with them. But alas, in a conversation about Bowie's career, we have to talk about Lodger.
In the event that this fantastic boy should turn to a rock.
Lodger continued Bowie's journey in art and experimental rock, but that's where the comparisons to Low and Heroes halt. Other styles on the album could be named as avant-pop, world, and new wave. The song structures are far less adventurous than that of the first two albums. Sure, they can be labeled as experimental, but for the most part, they follow more conventional song patterns. In analyzing individual songs, I wish I had a more intelligent or insightful response to the album's second track. But all I have written in my notes is that it sounds a bit like the Oompa Loompas from the Tim Burton version of Willy Wonka. So, do with that what you will, I guess.
African nightmare, one time moment, moment, falling, hullabaloo, and I slept to the nearest bar. Underline Sherman went too far. Went on a windfall, went to Sony, wonder how the dollar went down. Gotta get a quote.
Again, separating itself from Low and Heroes, Lodger abandons the instrumental B-sides concept with a consistent track list. All 10 songs have lyrics and range from 3 to 4 minutes in length. To be completely honest, none of them are really standouts for me, but given that in a one-year period, Bowie put out two of the best albums to ever grace rock music, I guess I'll give him a pass. So, 3 albums and 4 years later, where does this leave our star man? Well, with his life, work, and personality pieced back together, David made his way back to America, this time to the East Coast, to catch the new wave.
Scary monsters!
Berlin Trilogy was extremely successful artistically, it didn't quite measure up to Bowie's star status commercial success. That's why, in 1980, he decided to make a record with a more commercial appeal. Still collaborating with producer Tony Visconti, Bowie co-produced his 14th studio album, Scary Monsters and Super Creeps. With a new wave post-punk sound, Bowie blended perfectly into the New York City scene, alongside successful acts of the time such as Blondie and the B-52s. This record is a bit more planned out than his previous releases, and it shows. It is clear that Bowie put in some time beforehand to write lyrics and music. Many of the recordings on Low and Heroes were actually improvised on the spot, adding to the artistic merit of the album. For Scary Monsters, this wasn't the case. Now, that's not to say that the album isn't good, because the 3 big hits from it are some of my personal favorites of Bowie's. Let's take track 4, Ashes to Ashes, for example. The song was released as a single, and understandably so, as it has immense commercial appeal. But not only that, it has everything you could ever want from a Bowie song. The twangy yet funky intro immediately grabs your attention, and this excellent instrumentation carries on for the rest of the song. It also has the storytelling element of a killer Bowie song that much of the Berlin trilogy lacks. In the chorus, a callback is made to David's very first persona, Major Tom. Ashes to ashes, funk to funky, we know Major Tom's a junkie. Now, with that line, we get this great little Easter egg of sorts that was obviously exciting for the average Bowie fan at the time, adding to that commercial appeal he was trying to get. But at the same time, it's in no way a cheap trick. The lyric demonstrates Bowie's progression throughout his career as both himself and the personas he donned. Major Tom was his first character and in a way is a representation of all the other Bowies we've come to know. We know Major Tom was a junkie, as David was a junkie, as the Thin White Duke was a junkie. They're all one entity, and when Bowie hit an all-time low, so did Major Tom. So did all of them. With this new record, Bowie is fully reborn and ready to tackle new territory.
Ashes to ash and funk to funk it. We know Major Tom's a junkie, strung out in heaven's mind.
The album's title track, Scary Monsters and Super Creeps, is initially jarring, but I love it. I've never heard anything quite like this song. The sound of what I believe to be a dog barking in the background is almost haunting, but the song wouldn't be the same without it. Bowie's ability to keep you interested with his vocals alone shines in this song, and I have zero notes. Just sit back and enjoy the bizarre thrill of it all.
She had an aura of broom, she was tired, you can't hide me.
The other track that I absolutely have to talk about, and is possibly the best known from the album, is Fashion. Fashion has clear funk and reggae influences, and is an obvious dance track. It has been compared to Golden Years from Station to Station, and I can definitely hear that. It's Golden Years amped up with a sprinkle of glitter. If you don't know what I mean, well, I guess have a listen for yourself.
Fashion.
Seven tracks on the album have a pretty consistent sound. Bowie's interest in Asian culture is again represented on this album, the first line of the track being delivered by a woman speaking Japanese. Apparently, Bowie insisted she delivered the lines in her best macho samurai voice to break down sexist attitudes towards women, particularly Asian women who had been subject to fetishization in American and British culture at the time. John Lennon. The instrumentation on the record is mainly distorted and, in this way, takes the experimentation of the Berlin series and runs with it. Overall, although it's not everyone's cup of tea and likely not Bowie's most artistically daring release, I love this album. However, not as much as I love the one that comes next. After taking a few years to focus on acting and a few musical collaborations, Bowie came back with his next and, spoilers, last fantastic album for a good few decades. Let's Dance, released in April of 1983, is one of those rare albums you come across with absolutely zero skips. Could it be due to its mere 8-song track list and obvious commercial appeal? Perhaps. But there's nothing any music snob could say to me that would change my love for this record. Let me tell you why. This record is actually the first that I ever heard played on vinyl. I remember my dad coming home from a grandparent's house with a new turntable that he bought and all his old albums. As soon as he put the needle down, I was in awe. The opening song, Modern Love, is the absolute perfect album opening. It's catchy, it grabs your attention, but it still builds. It's hopeful and full of energy, and that sax solo, I mean, come on, magnificent. The last thing I'll say about this song is that if you say you don't sing along, you're a liar. Track on the album, China Girl, is actually a cover of the same song Bowie recorded with Iggy Pop for The Idiot. Although the song is jarring at first listen, it is actually a criticism of racial stereotypes surrounding Asian women, yet again. The music video furthers this message. If that interests you at all, I'd give it a watch. I'm sure you can find it on YouTube. The song itself is, whoa, big surprise, very good. And if you love a good David Bowie talk singing song, this is the track for you. The track is likely the album's best-known song, so I won't waste time explaining it to you. All I'll say is that this is my favorite part. If you should fall into my arms, tremble like a flower. As I said before, this album has zero skips in my opinion, but one song I wanted to highlight is Cat People, Putting Out Fire. This is, again, a sort of cover, given that it is a re-recording of a song Bowie himself made for a film soundtrack in 1982. The delivery of the line, putting out fire with gasoline, is absolutely thrilling, and if it sounds familiar and you can't put your finger on it, it's because it was featured in the Tarantino film Inglourious Basterds from 2009. And I've been putting out fire with gasoline. Say you have to listen to this album all the way through, I mean it. It is definitely Bowie's peppiest record, and if you ever need a pick-me-up throughout the day, it's a great listen. Alright, now it's time to admit it. Not all of Bowie's work was as memorable as that of his releases up until 1983. Between 83 and 2016, Bowie put out 10 studio albums, but not many are very notable. He continued to tour and explore new genres, sometimes getting extremely experimental, but nothing really wowed us. That is, until it was too late. In 2016, David put out a surprise release called Black Star. 2 days later, he died of liver cancer. In the filler of amen. In the filler of amen. Stands a solitary candle. The world was in shock. Up until this point, Bowie enjoyed his time out of the spotlight. He got married to supermodel Iman, and together they had a daughter. He lived a normal life doing normal things. It was almost as if he had finally dropped the masks he donned, those that resembled characters and himself alike, and took some time to be David Jones for a while. But, in true Bowie fashion, when he realized he was dying, he made one last tribute to his fans. Black Star contained only 7 songs, each twinged with melancholy and retrospective observance. The standout of the album is Lazarus, and it is absolutely heartbreaking. Its message becomes clear with the delivery of the very first line. Look up here, I'm in heaven. I've got scars that can't be seen. I will spare you the tears of going too deep into this one. The gist of it is that Bowie was devoted to his fans and his art up until his dying breath. There's a video of his last performance ever that I watch and cry at every time. On an empty stage, days after suffering a heart attack, our starman, on a vast open stage, sings Life on Mars for the last time. Is there life on Mars? The death of David Bowie hit all music fans pretty hard. His legacy was boundless, impacting both British and American culture in many ways. Bowie was first and foremost a unique visionary. His impact on music also spread to performance and fashion, and his representation in the media allowed others like him, the weird and nonconforming, to feel as though they were seen. David's legacy was honored at the 2016 Brit Awards as he was awarded the Brit Icon Award. The award was accepted on the behalf of David and his family by his close friend and actor, Gary Oldman. In his acceptance speech, Gary said, "David's contribution, his influence on popular music, on culture itself, has no equal. He was the very definition, the living embodiment of that singular word, icon." Also in his speech, Gary shared what David said about his music to him. Music has given me over 40 years of extraordinary experiences. I can't say that life's pains or more tragic episodes have been diminished because of it, but it has allowed me so many moments of companionship when I felt lonely, and a sublime means of communication when I have wanted to touch people. It has been both the doorway of perception and the house that I live in. Following Gary's speech, a band, many of the members being individuals that David had worked with in the past, paid tribute to Bowie. At the end of an instrumental segment of various Bowie hits, Lord walked out on stage and performed Hunky Dory's Life on Mars. As you will recall, this is the last song David ever performed live. From Major Tom to the Thin White Duke, to Bowie in Berlin, to 80s Camp, to Lazarus, David Bowie was everything a performer ever needs to be. His appearance and sound may have changed, but what never wavered was his sense of authenticity and hunger for progress. He never wanted to stay comfortable in one role. He was always evolving and challenging the status quo. For this reason, he is not only renowned as one of the best musicians of all time, but as a trailblazer for performers everywhere. He challenges those he influences to think outside of the box, to be weird, to follow their impulses, and when things get tough, to look to the Starman. There's a Starman waiting in the sky. He'd like to come and meet us, but he thinks he'd blow our minds. There's a Starman. Now, before I go, to fill up a couple minutes that I have to spare, why not rank the Bowie albums that I've named in the last few episodes in terms of my favorites? As I said in the Kurt episode, I am in no way a music professional, simply a music fan. So, if you have a bone to pick with me after these opinions, feel free to reach out, but keep in mind that they are in fact just opinions. So, here they are. Bowie's albums, minus those that I didn't mention, ranked from least to greatest. My last pick has to be 1973's Pinups. The cover art is cool, but that's about all I can really recall about the album, to be completely honest with you. And for that reason, I have given it the bottom slot. Next, we have Bowie's very first album from 1967, David Bowie. Given that it was his first release, it's understandable that there isn't much wow factor to this record. The individuality that we have come to associate with Bowie simply just isn't there, and for that reason, I've ranked it at number 14. Coming in at 13, we have Diamond Dogs. I enjoy this record, but as I said last week, there isn't much excitement to it. Rebel Rebel is great, and is the reason I'll come back to the album from time to time, but the rest of it is a bit repetitive. However, it is still a solid record, it's just not top-notch for David Bowie standards. The album cover, however, is one of my favorites, picturing Bowie as a half-man, half-dog figure. I've always admired his talent for weirding out those who didn't understand him. Next on the list, we have Space Oddity. The record itself was put together fairly quickly as a result of the single success, and thus it lacks much of the artistic merit many of his other releases possess. But because Space Oddity is on it, I'm putting it at number 12. Right above Space Oddity, I have to put Lodger. Now I know, it's part of the Berlin Trilogy, which is supposed to give it a bit of a cachet, but there just simply isn't a single song on Lodger that I have downloaded, to be completely honest with you. For that reason, I had to put it at number 11. Now those rankings were easy enough for me, but this is where it starts to get a little bit tricky. The Man Who Sold the World has to be next for me, because I'm a selfish Nirvana fan and for that reason have an obnoxious respect for it. The title track and The Width of a Circle are both great in terms of guitar, and I'm a sucker for that, so I'm putting it at number 10. Also about this album, I wanted to mention something I forgot to in the previous episode. The cover art of it pictures David Bowie in a dress laying across a couch. Now, you may not think much of this today, given that a lot of artists are very androgynous in their style, and that's just part of our culture now. But at the time, in the 70s, that was a really big deal, and we have to thank Bowie for being able to have that sort of freedom that we have today. He was really a trailblazer, and that kind of shows in this cover art. Anyways, getting back on track, at number 9, we have Young Americans. I have mixed feelings about this record, given that the style is pretty much stolen from black culture, and given Bowie's influence at the time, it feels a little bit wrong. Despite this, the title track and Fame are both iconic songs of his, and so I've placed it above some of the lesser-known albums. Next, we have Black Star. The music on this album is fantastic. Lazarus is phenomenal, and the overall record is a beautiful farewell from Bowie to his fans. For this reason, I've placed it at number 8. Just above Black Star, we have Aladdin Sane. This record is one I actually didn't get much into before researching this episode, and now that I have, I've fallen in love with it, particularly the first two tracks. That one piano solo in Aladdin Sane, I've never heard it before, and it's actually fantastic. So if you haven't given it a listen, please do. And for that reason, I have put it in the number 7 slot. Next up, we have Scary Monsters and Super Creeps. I'm aware that this one isn't everyone's cup of tea, but as I said, I really love it. I won't repeat myself from earlier. All I'll say is that if you haven't given it a try, please open up your mind to it. I promise you. After a few listens, you'll really get into it. Just above Scary Monsters, I have ranked 1983's Let's Dance. A solid record, but for its lack of artistic and emotional depth, again, this is David Bowie terms, so please take these criticisms lightly, I've had to place it below some of the others. Speaking of which, next is Heroes from 1977, probably one of Bowie's best works. I love the album, but personally, instrumental tracks are often difficult for me to get through, so it's not in the top 4 for me. Coming down to the wire, at number 4, we have Low. In my opinion, the best of the Berlin trilogy, Low is my newfound love. I had Sound of Vision before I started researching the episode, but nothing else. I am currently taking my time to enjoy this record once every few days, and I am loving it. For its artistic merit, cultural significance, and overall just innovative sound, Low's at number 4 for me. Now, for our top 3. In 3rd place, we have Station to Station. Golden Years has been one of my Bowie favorites for a while now, but oh my god, have I fallen in love with Station to Station. I think I've listened to the title track about 100 times, maybe, in the past few weeks. I'm slightly obsessed, to say the least. It's weird, it's a roller coaster, it's innovative, it's Bowie. Coming in at number 2, Hunky Dory. A little part of me so badly wanted to rank this one first, A, because it has so many of my favorites on it, and B, I'm an obnoxious music fan who wants to be different and feels a bit predictable putting the rise and fall first. But alas, at number 1, we have the rise and fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars. But can you blame me? This album is the absolute essence of David Bowie. It was made when he was first making his mark on the culture during the height of the glam rock phase. Bowie made waves with his music and persona, and Ziggy himself became a cultural icon. The story arc in the album itself is fantastic. Every song is great. And once I start playing it, I am always dedicated to listening the full way through. That being said, that completes our second parter. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of The Downbeat. If you made it this far, congratulations, and I apologize if you were expecting an interview this week. I know I promised you that I might interview somebody from Laurier this week to get their opinions on David Bowie, but I think just the technical element of that would be a little more complicated than I can deal with right now. I'm currently recording out of my bedroom in my house with my friend's microphone. Thank you, Maggie, for lending it to me. But hopefully, maybe once I can actually get into the studio, perhaps, I would be able to sit down with somebody and actually have a conversation about music, which could be a fun time. Aside from that, if you have any content ideas, please feel free to send them my way. I'm trying to think of ideas that are not just artist-based that I could get into, maybe some cultural events, Woodstock, particular subgenres, Riot Girl perhaps, I don't know. So if you have any ideas, give me a DM over on Instagram. My Instagram is Megan Folsom, MeganFulsom. No dots or anything. I think I said that in a previous episode, but there's no dots or underscores, just my name. And that's it for this week. So thank you so much for listening, and I'll hope to see you next week. Bye.